Good evening, fellow bunny lovers, a descriptive which will take on added meaning later on. Happy Easter. It's time to roll away the stone, including me, Spider Robinson. You're the latest victim of Spider on the Web number 36, a user-supported podcast designed with your mind in mind, being brought to you, as always, under Creative Commons license, no derivatives, non-commercial, share alike. Happy times here. The supply of good-looking women in my home, always more than satisfactory, has suddenly quintupled this week with another on the way. My wife Jeannie's mother, Dorothy Rubico, and three of her four sisters, Lori O'Neill, Mary Rodericks, and Dory Leger, have all flown in from Massachusetts to help celebrate her birthday, and once our daughter Terry and son-in-law Haron da Silva arrive, we gon' pitch a ball, swing us up a main day breeze, and have us a good name. Partly in honor of all that extra estrogenic energy making the house glow faintly even in daylight, and partly to show that I hate Hillary Clinton for all the right reasons, I'm bringing you a podcast of nothing but remarkable women this week. Here, for example, is one Jeannie and I met on a cruise ship. A couple of years ago, Jim Richardson of JR Travel arranged a science fiction cruise from Vancouver up the Inside Passage to Alaska aboard Holland America's SS Zuiderdam. It's much too long a story to tell here. I'll just say we had a serious blast. Cruise ships are as much fun as Robert and Jenny Heinlein always told us they were. Our fellow passengers included my college roommate and oldest friend, Dr. Charles Daniels of Yarmouth, and his wife, Carol, Robert A. Heinlein's granddaughter, Dr. Amy Baxter, and her husband, Dr. Louis Calderon of Atlanta, and a full dozen other equally interesting and jolly souls, not counting Jim himself and his partner, Annie Goran. Among them was Gail Mead, a folk singer from California. We jammed some. We're both quite fond of James Taylor's Secret of Life, and we played each other some of our own stuff. Gail writes, sings, and plays guitar extremely well. A bunch of us spent most of the week talking about a lot of interesting stuff ranging from science fiction to reality, and at one point I found myself asking the group where the protest singers of today were, and Gail raised her hand and played me an early solo version of the song you're about to hear. After the cruise, she sent a good recording of it into the protest song competition at Neil Young's website and ended up among the top six, performing it at Largo in L.A. behind it. By now she has albums galore out, all tasty, which you can find at CD Baby or through www.gailmead.com. That's GALEMEAD.com. Sad to say, this song is still as relevant today as it was 2 years ago, the Iraq War now having gone on longer than did U.S. involvement in World War II. So here's Gail Mead with Letters Home.
I saw the car pull up outside. I knew what they would say. The Department of Defense regrets your Brian's passed away. Oh Lord, your Brian's passed away. Love of my life, light of my eye, how can tears they fall like rain, Lord, they fall like rain. And he wrote, dear Mary, I'm not allowed to
It's time for some of that there sinus friction stuff. In June, Bain Books will publish my next novel in hardcover, Very Hard Choices. It's the sequel to a novel called Very Bad Deaths, which is now out in Bain paperback. Very Bad Deaths, fair warning, contains the creepiest villain I've ever created and was the book that caused David Crosby to write me a letter, which changed my life for the better in many ways. I've already read you some early chapters from it in previous episodes of Spider on the Web, archived at my website. In weeks to come, I'll start reading you excerpts from the new one, Very Hard Choices. But right now, I'd like to read you a bit more of its prequel, a section about a woman so remarkable, I wish I could take credit for having invented her. But nearly all of what I'm about to recount actually happened just as I set it down, back in my college days. As we begin, our hero, Russell, has just begun to dimly suspect that the reason his pariah roommate Smelly reeks so badly is that he's a telepath who can't help it, and it hurts, and so he needs to keep people as far from him as he can. But that was the night the bunny walked into Wanda's Rest, and into legend. 1967, Chapter 4. Wanda's Rest had been, by all accounts, one of the best bordellos in the state of New York. A remarkable boast. When the Society of Mary of Geneva got a terrific deal on the 100-acre parcel just up the hill and built a large Catholic college on it, back in the late 40s. Wanda was a realist and had many powerful friends, including more than one whose collar was worn backwards. Negotiations were undertaken, conditions were sworn to, an accommodation was reached. The upstairs business was shut down forever. The bar downstairs became the whole business. It was the only bar remotely within walking distance of the college, and it was agreed that no other bar would ever be granted a license near there. The change suited nearly everybody, really. A monopoly bar just down the hill from a large college is, oddly enough, more lucrative than a good brothel, so Wanda was content. Her girls were much happier selling beer than themselves. And the powerful people who would now have to stop coming to Wanda's were, if the truth be known, getting just a bit long in the tooth to keep up a reputation in a whorehouse anyway. By 1967, just about the only lingering clue as to the previous nature of Wanda's Rest was that every one of Wanda's employees and staff was a hard-boiled, soft-hearted woman in her 50s who took drunken college boys absolutely in stride. Contrary to what a cynic might expect, not once was it ever even rumored that one of Wanda's gals had reverted to her former ways, even for a night. I'm sure it would have been hugely lucrative, and now that I'm in my 50s myself, I begin to see how appealing some of us brash, cute, shit-faced randy boys could have been. But Wanda had given the bishop and the mayor her word, and Wanda could make a cage full of lions leave a fresh steak alone if she wanted to. So, for the hundreds of desperately lonely, yearning, bursting young testosterone slaves who pass through Wanda's door every Friday and Saturday night, their only faint hope of sexual relief, dream more than hope, really, was virgin Catholic girls. Classmates who already knew exactly what jerks they were, and furthermore were being looked out for by uncannily wise barmaids and waitresses. Hope springs eternal within the human pants, of course. But I'd have to say that the underlying mood in Wanda's on any given weekend evening was a blend of manic optimism and maudlin despair, and the sexual tension was always thick enough to sink pythons into. A lineup of the most desperate guys would hover along the bar just inside the door. Bill Doan called the process by which this line sorted itself out, peckering order. It was exactly like a line of taxis waiting outside the terminal door at the airport. "Climb aboard, dear lady. I will be giving you a most particularly enjoyable ride." Each time a girl came in the door, whoever was first in line would leave the bar and go hit on her. "My name's Jack, and you're the prettiest girl come through that door all night. Can I buy you a drink?" Something over 95% of the time he would be shot down and would slink to the tail of the line while the girl went on to join her girlfriends in the back room. Once in a long while, she would nod, and then they would stop briefly to collect drinks and head for the back room together. It could have been any one of us. A junior named Fred Speciale happened to be the guy fate selected to be on deck at Wanda's Rest the November night the bunny walked in for the first time. She was unremarkable in Fred's opinion. Average height and weight. Her body looked okay, though it was hard to be sure with a winter coat over it. Blonde hair, long and straight, caught back in a ponytail. Her face was quite nice, beautiful in a way, and missed being pretty only because of the strange expression on it. She looked like somebody brave reporting for her mammography. She stood just inside the door and scoped the room, dubiously. Well, as long as they weren't actively vomiting or brandishing a knife, it was all the same to Fred. Baring his teeth, hoping against hope as always, he approached her. Guys just after him in line monitored his progress with a mild professional interest.
"Hi, I'm Ace Speciale, and you're the best-looking woman to come in that door all night. May I buy you a drink?"
She looked him square in the eye, unsmiling. "No," she said in a voice that carried clear to the end of the bar, "but you can fuck me." And before he knew it, she was leading him by his necktie out to the parking lot and directly into the back seat of a car, where without preamble or foreplay of any kind, she pulled down both their pants and fucked him 3 times in a row without giving him a chance to lose his erection in between. At some point, he found himself lying on gravel with his pants down. She had pushed him off her and out of the car. He saw her get out, pull up her pants, and zip them up.
"Jesus," he croaked. "That was incredible."
She tossed a large, sodden wad of Kleenex to the ground beside him, stepped over him without a glance, and walked back into the bar on unshaky legs. Fred gave thought to lying there until he died, but his ass was cold. He managed to climb up the open car door until he was on his feet, pulled his own pants up, and set out for Wanda's front door, tacking a little against a sudden wind. By the time he got there, the girl, it suddenly came to him that he did not have even a first name for her, was already coming back out again, leading Tommy Flaherty by his necktie this time. She ignored Fred as she passed him. She fucked 23 guys that night. At some point after the first dozen or so, old Wanda herself, a slim redhead pushing 70, came out to talk to her. They walked off to a corner of the parking lot together and spoke in low voices for maybe 5 minutes. Then Wanda went back inside, and the guy whose turn it was went back inside, and the marathon resumed. Of the 23, it later turned out that 7 had thought to ask her name. None had gotten even a first name out of her. By the time Wanda's closed that night, she was known to everyone present as the Bunny. By lunchtime next day, every single person on the campus, male or female, was either talking or thinking about the Bunny. Everybody had an opinion, even if they kept it to themselves. Nobody had fact one. Attempts to elicit a useful description of her from the almost 24 closest witnesses proved largely frustrating. No clear consensus could be reached on any individual feature of her face, which didn't surprise any of the girls much. But they found it baffling that nobody who'd been with her in that humid backseat could positively state even the simplest basic parameters of her body. Breast size, ass size, waist-to-hip ratio, thigh flab, quantity and placement of hair, with any degree of confidence. Except for one specific body part, about which each of the 23 proved capable of writing sonnets. Even those who actually had some authentic previous sexual experience, everyone claimed to, agreed hers was in a class by itself. One in particular, Eddie Faulkner, was such a notorious cocksman, he was comfortable admitting his own unique experience, at least to us guys.
"Fellas, I was so damn drunk and, tell the truth, put off a little, I went limp before I could get it in. Didn't make the least bit of difference. I swear to God, it sucked me inside and wrung me out twice before I even had a chance to think of something sexy to think about. You ever want a diamond dildo? Give her one made of coal.
Yeah, I was next to last man in, Bobby Joe Innes agreed. And even by then, she could have made the battery fly out of a flashlight.
Suddenly, his expression was strange. Almost sad.
Funniest thing, though. Just about the time she had me thrashing and squealing like a throat-cut dog, I happened to open my eyes and see her face, and
it was like she was alone in the gymnasium, doing jumping jacks.
Now for a natural musical segue, here's an extremely sexy woman with a handful of bananas. That is to say, this is Carla Bley and the Lost Chords, last May in Le Mans, playing part of the Banana Quintet, this being in fact the fourth banana, known as the Banana Quintet Part 4. And by the way, if anything about the chord sequence employed here sounds vaguely familiar, what can I say but, Carla, I want you. She's so heavy. That's Carla Bley, composer, arranger, and instrumentalist on a level with Charles Mingus. Statues should be raised to that woman. And now, back to the bunny.
All around campus, guys met each other's eyes and then looked away. And then they began to talk loudly to one another. Some spoke a lot of words, and some only a few short ones. But all of them were spoken with a curled lip, and what they all boiled down to was, "Ooh, gross." Guys who had girlfriends said it most emphatically, especially if their girlfriend was present. But the rest of us, too, felt an odd need to reassure one another of how disgusted and repulsed we were by the bunny's conduct. What an incredible, skanky pig we considered her to be. We made cruel and stupid jokes about her, and about the 23 losers who had disgraced themselves by consorting with her. God, how desperate could you be? And then we all made our excuses, went back to our rooms, and spent long periods of time looking at ourselves in the mirror, frowning. The bunny had appeared on a Friday. Needless to say, the following night the line to get into Wanda's Rest stretched around the building and two blocks back up the hill. Fistfights occurred over place in line before anyone even knew for sure she would reappear that night. When she did arrive a little after 9, three guys stepped forward simultaneously and said in chorus, "Hi, can I buy you a drink?" "No, but I'll fuck you, you, and you in that order," she said, and took her first choice by the necktie and led him back out the door to the parking lot. The place went nuts. Wanda had to come out from her office and back and restore order. The shotgun she held casually down at her side helped. She required a line to form of those interested in visiting the parking lot with the bunny and declared that anyone leaving the line lost his spot and anyone cutting in was 86th forever. That night, the bunny accommodated 37 guys. By the third man, she had dispensed with the social formality of coming back in the bar each time to get the next one. It became more like waiting in the confession line. It was your turn when the guy before you came back. Except that now, he had a goofy grin on his face and walked funny. The bunny established two rules. First, no voyeurs. She kept her car parked around behind Wanda's and passed the word that if she ever saw so much as a single face peek around the corner, she would drive away and never return. One or two clowns naturally tried to get away with it, but found themselves significantly hampered by having the living shit kicked out of them by a vigilante squad. Rule 2, no oral sex, in either direction. In extreme cases of wagging wand, she would, reluctantly, offer limited manual assistance for as long as 30 seconds. After that, they said, you were on your own. It will not surprise you that no one ever admitted to impotence, but I think that was the simple truth. That is a bit hard to believe, but if anyone had failed conclusively, I think she would have kicked him out of the car well before his 5 minutes were up. That never happened once. All part of her legend. She did not return on Sunday night. It didn't surprise anyone much. Wanda's bartenders, all former professionals, had assured us that nobody could sustain that kind of pace 3 nights in a row. Much beer was consumed in sorrow, nonetheless. She did not return on Monday night, or any subsequent weeknight. By Wednesday, everyone understood and reluctantly accepted that the bunny was a strictly weekend phenomenon. The next Friday, the crowd around Wanda's was so thick and intense it was difficult to see the building, and the line stretched all the way back up the hill. The bunny showed up at 8:20 this time and took on 52 guys. Someone worked the math and reported she had it down to an average of 5 minutes a man. The next night, she only managed 46. The cops showed up at around 10, and her private negotiations with them used up a whole hour, while the men of St. William Joseph waited inside in wild impatience. She again failed to show on Sunday night, but there was a related incident. A lot of guys had showed up purely on the hope that she might change the pattern this week. When she didn't show, they became surly and frustrated, so they were feeling territorial when some guys showed up from another college 10 miles away, drawn by rumor. The riot squad had to be dispatched, and the emergency room was full that night. Next Friday night, I found myself getting ready to take a stroll down to Wanda's. It had taken me that long to fold. I can't tell you how many hours I devoted to debating with myself whether or not to bang the bunny. And there were countless others like me in both men's dorms. The antinomy was exquisitely agonizing for a young man. It will be hard for you to grasp, but our problem was not fear that she might be diseased. This was 1967. The sexual revolution was just dawning. None of us even knew anyone who might know someone who had ever had a venereal disease. We had certainly heard about them, and what we had heard was that they could be totally cured with a simple series of shots. That long ago, it was true. It did not bother anyone much at all that the bunny flatly refused to let anybody use a rubber. If anything, the cork was endearing. The dilemma was more than just a matter of taste, too, although that, too, was clearly a factor. What it came down to for a lot of us was a question of pride, of self-respect, of identity. Am I the kind of guy who would bang the bunny? And equally important, if I am, do I want everybody to know it? Certainly there could be no trace of Cockman's glory in it. Anyone with a pulse and a penis could have her. There had been one or two candidates that many observers had expected her to reject, but she hadn't. She didn't require flattery, handsomeness, wit, charm, sexual expertise, or even basic hygiene. Breath was not a factor. She never kissed. Nor was performance anxiety a serious factor. By all accounts, the bunny simply did not permit failure. The central question was, what would a real man do? Did not a real man take advantage of every single receptive vulva he encountered? Or did he maintain some sort of minimal standards? Was some sort of chase, some symbolic conquest, some kind of surrender won essential? Did it matter to a real macho stud what was going on north of the warm, moist, contracting tube? Would it not be degrading, disgusting to wallow where so many others had wallowed? Would it not be embarrassing, shaming, to reveal yourself before the whole school as someone who accepted the description of himself as a penis with a pulse? What girl was going to go out with you after you had publicly revealed yourself to be a rotting animal, willing to make use of any vagina with a pulse? In those days, if you were Catholic or even ex-Catholic and wished to partake of the sexual revolution, you were required to tell yourself and any co-ed who would listen that what you wanted was not mere animal sex, but making love. This was a profound, magical, deeply beautiful and spiritual thing, a deep sharing and growing together, a natural expression of love, a hard stance to maintain after you've been seen lining up for the bunny. A man could end up trading his total and entire prospects at a four-year college for a single five-minute interlude in a ripe and humid backseat. And were the other girls wrong to be revolted, as they surely and loudly were? Was not what was being done to the bunny a degradation of her womanhood, even if she solicited it? Was it not a kind of desecration of the whole concept of the male-female relationship, a blanket insult to women? If other girls watching took it to mean, this is what they would all like to do to us if they could, would they be wrong? Finally, what of the bunny herself? If she derived even a morsel of pleasure from what happened and happened and happened in that backseat, nobody had caught her at it yet. Was there not clearly something wrong with her inside? Some volcanic self-hatred or corrosive self-disgust that drove her to so debase herself? And if so, was it then not dishonorable to take advantage of her affliction? All that on one side. And on the other side,
but Jesus, man, it's a guaranteed lay!
It was, as Bill Doan called it, a dilemma of the horns.
Well, to keep you on those horns just a while longer, here's the great Blossom Dearie. She began her career in 1950, I believe, and is still performing regularly today in New York City. She's sort of the original template for Diana Krall. She's a songwriter of great musical sophistication, a very talented pianist and arranger, and a gifted singer with a voice of subtle but powerful eroticism. I'm trying hard to get permission to podcast at least a few of her most immortal commercial recordings, and her people keep assuring me it'll happen any minute now, but I can't stand it any longer. Here's a track I can podcast because I taped it off NPR, which has not made it commercially available. Here now, backed by the great Marion McPartland on her radio institution Piano Jazz, is Blossom Dearie singing about another of my favorite musicians in all the world, of whom she too was apparently quite fond.
Words and music are all that I need. I will follow wherever they lead. And I'm finding more fun in the game. A darling boy has brought me joy, sweet Georgie Fame. Oh, I heard him one night quite by chance. Now wherever I'm walking, I dance. And London is not quite the same, 'cause when he sings, the city swings, sweet Georgie Fame. London Bridge is falling down. Pop songs I hear with suspicion, but now from Broadway to Festival Hall, I have listened and I've heard them all. And they say I'm a real swinging dame. Yet I'm impressed, my ears are blessed, Georgie are blessed with Georgie fame. So stay a while, you'll see him smile, you won't complain. His music's sweet, you'll miss your train. My goose is cooked, I'm getting hooked on Georgie.
That's Miss Blossom Dearie in 2002, backed by Marion McPartland on her NPR program, Piano Jazz, which I immensely recommend. And now, back to the bunny.
1967, Chapter 5. Timing was important, and damn tricky. Ideally, you wanted to be as close to the front of the line as possible. Get it over with as quickly as possible and crawl back up the hill to the dorm. Certainly it was essential to at least be in the first 40 or so. To stand on public display as a lecher all night long and then not get laid was simply unthinkable. The problem was, some guys had absolutely no pride whatsoever and would begin lining up well before the sun went down. If you wrestled your way into their midst, there you stood in broad daylight in line for the bunny. For hours, being harangued and berated by flying squads of what were just then beginning to call themselves feminists. But if you waited for sundown and the anonymity of darkness, by then there'd already be at least 24 guys ahead of you in line. So, half an hour before sunset, that third Friday night, I was in my room, checking my appearance in the mirror before departing. The long hippie hair that I'd spent all summer growing in the face of ferocious pressure from my parents was pulled back hard into a ponytail. The ponytail was stuffed up under a watch cap that looked nothing like my trademark Aussie bush hat. My beard had shortened by an inch and lost its pathetic attempted sideburns. Instead of my usual brown imitation vinyl imitation bomber's jacket with imitation capoc falling out of the seams, I wore a big gray parka borrowed from Bill Doan with enough furry collar to satisfy Liberace. My whole silhouette was different. I'd swapped my customary bell-bottom jeans for the pants my mother had packed for me. They had creases. And instead of fry boots with heels that brought me up to 6'3", I wore loafers that changed my height, stride, and style. I turned a few times before the mirror in the dance of the nitwit who hopes for a glimpse of himself from behind. I added a scarf to the ensemble for flexibility, and took my glasses off and tucked them in my shirt pocket. Perfect, I couldn't see the mirror. Break a leg on the way downhill. I put the glasses back on and affixed clip-on sunglasses. Better. I wished I could detect in my innermost self even a particle of sexual arousal. Partly for reassurance, and partly for distraction from the queasy churning a few inches higher up. My cunning brain, the result of millions of years of evolution, had sampled the mixture of anticipation, fear, guilt, excitement, and repulsion I was running through it, realized I would shortly need to be in peak condition to deal with this crisis, and promptly abdicated control to my gut, which sagely decided that whatever the hell was going on up there between the ears, what would best help me right now was equal measures of nausea, heartburn, and gas. Bad gas. Half a joint of Panama Red had failed to quell the situation, and I needed to save the other half. For afterward. Enough. Time to go. If I was going. I tried to smile at myself in the mirror, and failed, and turned to the door, and it opened, and Smelly walked in and stopped in his tracks and stared at me. Well, we stared at each other. And that's the weird part, because I swear from the moment he came in the room his eyes never left mine. He didn't have any opportunity to really take in my altered appearance, and yet somehow I was sure that he knew instantly, knew, what I was planning to do. His eyes squinted in what I took to be disapproval. For maybe 10 seconds we stood there in silence. Then I glanced at my watch, and he nodded and stepped away from the door, and I left. The direct route to Wanda's from my dorm was to go out the front door, straight across the center of the campus commons past the gym building, out the north gate, and then three steep blocks down Dryer Street. I slipped out the back door, planning to go out the west gate, rarely used because it didn't go anywhere useful, and walk around most of the perimeter of the campus. Nobody would see me until I got to the top of Dryer. But as I was nearing the gate, a female voice I didn't recognize said, "Russell Walker?" For a wild instant, I fantasized that the bunny had been unable to wait for me and had come up the hill to get me. But even I couldn't sustain that one for more than a microsecond. Whoever this was, she was doubtless as far from being the bunny as she could be. And whatever she had in mind, she was a distraction I could not afford, threatening to make me late. It had taken me 2 weeks of rationalization to get myself this far. I knew if I didn't go through with it tonight, I never would. Even as I turned toward her voice, I was already saying, "Look, I'm sorry, but whatever it is you want to..." And then the breath I would have used to finish the sentence left me in a little silent huff. I stopped walking and stopped thinking about walking and stopped thinking and stared. The Italians are wrong. It isn't anything at all like a thunderbolt. It's like getting slapped in the face with pixie dust. Your cheeks tingle. Time seems to slow about 10%. Your vision sharpens about 10%, but your peripheral vision shrinks an equal amount. Somebody turns the treble way up, and everything takes on a slight echo that lets you know the recording devices have switched on. "Your roommate said I could catch you here about this time tonight. My name is Susan Krause," she said. "I'm in your Lit 205 class." "No, you're not," I heard some incredible asshole say, using my voice. She blinked. "Oh, good, contradictor, that's endearing." "I'd know," I insisted. Her face went through that little evolution where the mouth opens just slightly wider and the eyebrows go up and down a few millimeters, and it means, "Ah, I get it." "I just transferred in," she said. Demonstrate capacity for inferential reasoning. "Ah, you were in Cassidy's class."
"Yes."
Mr. Cassidy had been colorful even for an English teacher. Picture a Peter O'Toole built like Jimmy Cagney, gloriously pickled most of the time. About a third of his students fiercely loved him because his wildly rambling lectures taught them so many fascinating things. The other two-thirds found him wildly frustrating because the things he taught them almost never had any noticeable connection to American literature, which, after all, they were in effect paying him to teach them, and very often undercut their most cherished misconceptions about life. "I had him last year," I said. "They treated him shitfully." It was important to me that she know which side I was on. I knew which side she was on. I knew a lot of things about her. Already. Just from that first look. That October, Mr. Cassidy had totaled his beloved Triumph one night and racked himself up so bad they said anyone sober would have surely died. And his department chairman had waited until he'd been in the hospital for 31 days to visit him and tell him that the fine print said a medical leave of more than 30 days without advance notification and approval was grounds for loss of tenure, and Mr. Cassidy might want to use this period of recuperation to reflect on how to make the best use of the next phase of his life. "Yes, they did," she agreed fervently, as I had known she would. We looked at each other in silence for... how long? 5 seconds? 5 minutes? Even momentary conversational lulls usually make me anxious, but looking at her seemed to require my full attention and be a perfectly acceptable use of my time. It was she who finally said, "If you were on your way somewhere..." I tried to think where I might be going out the west gate, but it was all residential that way, out to well past walking distance. "Just out for a walk, I guess." "Oh," she took a half step back. "Put a stop to that. Was there something..." "Well, yes. Did you write a paper on Red Badge for Boudreau?" A grenade of pleasure went off in my stomach. Dr. Boudreau had not only given me an A for a recent essay on the Red Badge of Courage, but had taken steps on my behalf to have it published in a critical journal so prestigious that contributors were paid 3 complimentary copies. "You heard about that?" "Your roommate and I were talking about the war. Xander, is it? He mentioned your paper. I can't believe nobody ever interpreted Red Badge as an anti-war novel before," she said. "I can't believe anybody ever read it any other way," I admitted. Me either. It's so obvious. I mean, the only times the guy ever succeeds as a warrior
are the times he goes nuts, right, loses his humanity.
Well, loses or abandons it, right, exactly. Well, that scene right before the first battle where he feels like he's in a moving box.
Would you like to walk with me? I asked.
And then I'm not sure about the choreography of what happened next, who did what, who went first, but when it was over, her arm was in mine, and we were walking out the west gate together.
So what was it why?
I was hoping I could ask to borrow a copy. I've only heard about your paper, and I'd like to read it for myself.
Are you a Stephen Crane freak?
She shook her head. Peace freak.
Ah, were you there when they liberated the library?
We basically walked and talked all night, with intervals of doing neither, sharing silent companionship beside the reservoir and again on a hill overlooking the state highway. And it wasn't until after I'd dropped her off at her dorm and was halfway to my own, whistling, that I remembered the existence of the bunny. When I did, I grinned wryly. It was like remembering my boyhood intention to be a cowboy when I grew up. As far as I was concerned, the bunny was history. I didn't know how right I was, until I got back to my own dorm and found the entire building in mourning. The bunny had failed to show the night before. People had waited. A few were reportedly still waiting down the hill, but there'd been no sign of her. Nor was there any that night, or any subsequent night. As mysteriously as she had appeared in the first place, the bunny had vanished for good. What did I care? I was in love, for the first time in my life, and, I could already sense, for the last as well.
Now, in the book Very Bad Deaths, that's where I left the bunny for several chapters and several decades. But if I were to do that to you here, I'd feel kind of like a tease, you know. So I'm going to take you off the hook. We'll jump ahead to a point where Russell has met up again with Smelly, now known as Xander. At this point, Russell is a grieving widower, and Smelly, now known as Xander, badly needs his help to prevent several murders, help Russell has just reluctantly agreed to provide.
He stood up. Good night, Russell. Thank you for helping.
I haven't yet. I'm not convinced that I can.
Well, thanks for agreeing to try, then. We can do this, you know.
Uh-huh. Well, I know we have to try.
Yes, we do.
He turned and began to leave. But he stopped in the doorway and turned, and after a pause he said, so softly his voice sounded almost normal,
"She really was special."
I swallowed hard. It stung, just like a hard slap, made my eyes water and everything. But only like a slap, not like a punch to the heart.
"Yes, she was. Why she chose me, I'll never understand."
He nodded.
"That's right."
He turned to go again, and this time I stopped him. "Xander?"
"Yes?"
I felt stupid, but I went ahead anyway. Basically the story of my life. "You really think I would have done the bunny?"
"I know so," he said.
That wasn't the way I remembered it, but I had a sneaking feeling that he was right, that the way I remembered it was bullshit. "Huh. God, I haven't thought of her in years. I wonder what the story was with her."
"Oh, I can tell you that."
"No shit."
"I was out for a walk early one Sunday morning, and she drove past me on her way back to the School of Nursing. All she could think about was why she was doing what she'd just been doing."
"Right," I said. "I remember now. The year after that, Bill Doan dated a nurse, and he mentioned seeing a picture of the bunny in their yearbook from the year before." I frowned. "It never seemed to make any sense. I mean, you'd think a nurse of all people would be more likely to appreciate things like hygiene, genetics."
"She didn't want to be a nurse," Zudi said.
"No? What did she want to be?"
"A housewife."
I grinned. "No, really."
"A farm housewife. She was daffy in love with her high school sweetheart, who was 2,000 miles away at agricultural college studying to become a scientific farmer, and all she wanted to do in the world was marry him and populate his farm with fat kids. Unfortunately, he failed to knock her up by the end of that summer, and so her parents had forced her to go off to nursing school at the other end of the country. The first week there, she suddenly thought, what if I were pregnant and just found out now? Why, Her parents would have to let her drop out of nursing school and let her boyfriend make an honest woman out of her, that's what. All she needed to do was become pregnant.
Oh my God, I began to giggle.
So quickly that all concerned would readily accept her boyfriend as the father. Since there was no telling why they had failed to conceive so far, it certainly had not been from lack of trying, she had to assume at least part of the problem might lie with her. So she felt it would be good to attack the problem with maximum force. Take every step she could to maximize the chances of conception.
I was laughing now.
She was prudent enough to choose a college bar rather than some bucket of blood downtown where the men might have been more virile but definitely would have been more volatile, and a Catholic college at that.
I will be goddamned. I had control of the laughter now, but I couldn't stop grinning. And it worked, right? That's why she disappeared? He nodded.
Tested positive, and she was literally on the next train smoking.
Jesus. My smile went away. Jesus. So if I'd...
Yes, if you had made up your mind to go down and see her a week earlier than you did, you would have been one of the candidates for father of her baby.
Wow. The thought of a second human being wandering the planet burdened with my genetic shortcomings was weird. On the other hand, it would be nice to have a child somewhere who didn't hate me yet.
There's time to fix that, you know, he said.
Good night, Xander. Enough is enough for one night.
Yes, it is. Good night, Russell. Thank you.
For what?
For being who you are.
I thought of several flip responses. Instead, I said, You're welcome. It has not come without effort. He nodded.
I know.
He turned and left.
Those excerpts were all taken from Blackstone Audiobooks edition of Very Bad Deaths, available at www.blackstoneaudio.com. I'm going to play you out now with one last remarkable woman, the youngest of my four sisters-in-law, Dori Leger. I mentioned earlier that most of Jeannie's sisters are here to help celebrate her birthday. Dori brought along a special present. There's a song that she began about a year ago, got about a minute and a half into, and stalled on, and sent us a copy of. We both really liked it and kept juicing her every time we talked to her to finish the damn thing. Well, it turns out that she did, and she brought along a special home recording of it as a birthday present for her big sister. The piano on this is by Matt Richard, who I played you last podcast. I believe he plays bass as well. And the additional help was provided by Dori's son, Ian. That little hold the fifth underneath harmony there at the end was his idea, for instance. Here's Dori Leger singing her own composition, Stranger to Me Now.
I thought I knew you.
has it there might soon be a label smart enough to record and distribute a whole CD of jazz work of Dorian Don Leger. Meanwhile, you can catch their work in contemporary blues by going to www.bluestrainband.com, where you will find their new CD, Blues Train Band. That's Spider on the Web 36. If you've had a good time, please consider dropping a sawbuck or two in the PayPal hat on the way out. These electrons don't grow on trees, you know. By the way, my brand new reading of one of my own short stories, Distraction, will have its world premiere shortly on the excellent podcast Starship Sofa, which I enthusiastically recommend you check out. This is Spider Robinson thanking you for your donations and subscriptions, and hoping that you'll be back next week for Spider on the Web 37.